This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, November 30th, 2001. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Talks underway in Bonn, Germany to shape the political future of Afghanistan are falling apart at the seams. A Bush administration cabinet member will stand trial on charges she defrauded Native Americans, and 60 of Philadelphia's public schools could become privatized. By Monday, we'll have a report. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The UN General Assembly narrowly rejected an Iraqi proposal to study the effects of depleted uranium weapons. Susan Wood reports from the United Nations.
UN diplomats say pressure from Washington caused the 189-nation General Assembly to vote down the Iraqi plan. The Assembly's Committee on Disarmament and International Security approved the plan earlier this month, also by a narrow margin. Baghdad has long insisted on a link between the depleted uranium shells used by U.S.-led forces in the Gulf War and a two-thirds increase in the number of Iraqis with leukemia and other cancers from 1989 to 1997. In a separate but related development, the Security Council yesterday voted unanimously to extend the U.N. Oil for Food program. The program authorizes Iraq to sell oil to generate revenue for importing food, medicine, and other essentials to help Iraqi civilians affected by the 11-year-old sanctions against the country. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
The General Accounting Office is urging the Bush administration to indefinitely postpone a decision on whether to build a nuclear waste storage site in Nevada's Yucca Mountain, and is raising serious questions about whether it could ever be built as currently conceived. From Capitol Hill, Kata Mester.
According to a draft report by the General Accounting Office, the Energy Department is unlikely to achieve its goal of opening an underground nuclear waste repository at Yucca Mountain by its 2010 target date, and has no reliable estimate of when and at what cost such a repository could be opened. The GAO report also disclosed that officials surveying the Yucca Mountain site may not be describing the facilities that the Department of Energy would develop accurately. Observers anticipate that Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham will urge President Bush to name the Yucca Mountain site as home to some 78,000 tons of radioactive waste. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, I'm Kata Mester.
Two Somali shops have their goods back after U.S. officials seized them earlier this month. From Seattle, Martha Baskin.
In a surprising about-face, the Treasury Department allowed the Somalian owners of two shops who shared space with a money transfer operation accused by the Bush administration of helping fund Osama bin Laden to retrieve their non-perishable items yesterday. Neither business owner has been charged with any crime. In the pouring rain, immigrant shopkeepers loaded U-Haul trucks with confiscated dry goods, clothing, meat coolers, bookshelves, and CDs. The American Civil Liberties Union said it was a classic case of law enforcement coming in with a heavy hand. A Treasury Department spokesperson, Rob Nichols, maintains there was no error made in seizing the assets and closing down shops that shared space with Barakat Wire Transfer. Nichols told the Seattle Post-Intelligencer that it was reasonable, quote, for the government to return the store items while continuing to investigate the nature of the relationship between the man who ran Barakat and the owners of the grocery and clothing stores. A claim has been filed against the Treasury Department to cover perishable items that were disposed of, as well as lost wages. The shop owners are still owed money seized from cash registers during the three-day raid. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin in Seattle.
Bolivian water rights activist Oscar Oliveira is under police supervision. Oliveira's supporters say his only crime is leading protests against water privatization. Kelia Ramirez has more.
The charges, including sedition, conspiracy, instigating public disorder, and criminal association, were filed in July, but the government had given Oliveira direct assurances later that month that they had been dropped. The Coalition in Defense of Water and Life says the charges are related to Oliveira's role in opposing water export laws and successfully reversing privatization of the water system of Cochabamba, Bolivia's third-largest city. The coalition also accuses the government of making the arrest to create distractions while negotiating with coca growers who are resisting U.S.-sponsored coca eradication programs. Oliveira was released after several hours, but must report to police every 72 hours and may be detained at any time. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
Four South African police officers yesterday received jail sentences of between 4 and 5 years each for encouraging their police dogs to attack three black Mozambican immigrants. Naeem Jenna reports from Johannesburg.
The policemen were charged after the discovery of a video showing them jeering and kicking the men as the dogs savaged their arms, legs, and faces. The video outraged South Africans. It reopened debates about racism within the South African police force years after the end of apartheid. The four policemen last week pleaded guilty to charges of aggravated assault. Two other policemen pleaded not guilty. Their trial continues. This is Naeem Jenna in Johannesburg for Free Speech Radio News.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
The danger to U.S. troops in Afghanistan is growing as the size of the Taliban and the al-Qaeda network decreases. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld predicts there will be more American soldiers captured or killed. But he stresses this will not deter the U.S. from its mission to, in his words, bring the Taliban and Osama bin Laden's terrorist network to their knees. Rumsfeld says American troops understand the danger they're in and see the bigger picture. Talks on Afghanistan's future reached an impasse today after the political head of the Northern Alliance demanded elections for an interim government and objected to plans for international peacekeepers. The stall in talks came amid a rift between the alliance's leadership in Afghanistan and its delegation at the conference outside Bonn. In another sign of alliance divisions, an ethnic Pashtun delegate walked out of the talks in Bonn to protest the lack of representation for his ethnic group, the largest one in Afghanistan. He is among many Afghan groups that say the people of Afghanistan are being left out. Charles Michael Ray reports from Bonn.
American bombs continue to pound areas around Kandahar while the Northern Alliance battles for control of the last Taliban-controlled area of Afghanistan. Meanwhile, in Bonn, a coalition of the democratic groups of Afghanistan spoke out today saying that the four delegations who are negotiating on the future government of Afghanistan are not representative of the Afghan people. Dr. Rangan Spanta, spokesperson for the Alliance of Democracy, says the delegations represent Western interests and the armed Afghan factions they are supporting.
There's no democratic movement inside of this dialogue there, and this is not acceptable for UN nations that they only support or give support to the warring factions, representative of all the dark Afghanistan of the warring factions and of the regional powers.
In the northern Afghan city of Mazar-e-Sharif, the bodies of hundreds of prisoners of war are slowly being removed from the prison where they were massacred by Northern Alliance forces and American bombs. Officials with the Northern Alliance at the UN conference in Bonn denied that there was any human rights abuses in Mazar-e-Sharif, while UN officials say they do not know whether they will investigate the incident. But Spanta says the events during the Northern Alliance control of Afghanistan during the 90s and what happened at Mazar-e-Sharif are proof that the Northern Alliance cannot effectively govern and ensure security for the citizens of Afghanistan.
I don't think that the Northern Alliance will be a stable power in Afghanistan, while they never could do it. And we have seen it from 92 to 96, what they have done. And if you now look at the streets, at the roads and the houses, they are looting, there are killings. So it's the same situation like before.
Breakdowns and instability within the factions of the Northern Alliance were evident at the talks in Bonn when Abdul Qadir, the governor for the Pashtun province of Nangarhar and one of the delegates for the Northern Alliance, left the talks over what UN officials said were disagreements within the delegation. The brother of Qadir, Nasula Arsley, echoed the statement of the democratic groups, saying that Qadir left because he was not pleased with the conference, because he said it did not come from the Afghan people, but rather the UN.
Before he went to the conference, we were not very hopeful of the conference. Firstly, the creation of the conference was not by Afghans, and the realities of Afghanistan were not considered.
UN spokesperson Ahmed Fazi says the future security of Afghanistan is one of the main points of contention of the talks. Other Afghan delegations in Bonn condemned the massacre at Mazar-e-Sharif, saying that the new government would prevent such occurrences while insisting that they are working towards a democracy. But the question remains if the new Afghan government will answer to the people of Afghanistan or be ruled as it has for the last 23 years by the will of the military and outside foreign interests. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Bonn.
A group of 80 Afghan exiles met in Bonn to discuss rebuilding civil society in Afghanistan, parallel to the political UN talks. Fariba Nawa reports from Bonn.
The Afghan diaspora, 40 women, 40 men, of all the country's ethnic groups came together to talk about the issues that the politicians at the United Nations conference would not. The members of the Civil Society Conference for Peace and Reconstruction in Afghanistan are discussing issues including reconstruction, human and women's rights, demilitarization, legitimacy of leaders, and education. Seema Ghani, an Afghan British resident and aid worker with the charity group Khorasan.
We are the people that represents Afghanistan, whether they are real Afghans, whether they're inside Afghanistan or outside the country. The political group are just thinking about their specific role, and their specific role is the future government, where we're thinking of reconstructing the whole country. Our role is much bigger, and it's just the first step, and this will be continuous, not necessarily with the same 80 people sitting around the same table. So let's not worry about the fact that other people couldn't play a part this time around. Next time, there will be other people.
The UN urged the Swiss Peace Foundation to organize the conference as an accountability group, which include intellectuals, aid workers, and businessmen who have traveled from as far as Pakistan and Dubai to make sure the political delegates follow up on their promises. The participants are scheduled to meet the delegates and dispatch their suggestions. The conference, which is to last until Sunday, did not receive much press attention Friday, even though the UN has plagued it repeatedly in the press briefings. One of the criticism is that the participants, like the political delegates, are primarily exiles and that foreign countries are funding and organizing the event. Tanya Paffenhals, one of the organizers of the conference, responds to the criticism.
We really consider ourselves as a platform and as facilitators in this process. So I think that's not a problem that we are not from Afghanistan. It's, I think, on the contrary, it's good that we are not. Right. I think the debate, people from inside and people from the diaspora, is a very common debate. We know about this not only in Afghanistan but also in other places in the world. And it is true that there is always a danger that you will find people in exile, highly educated, that have a word to say, and that you lose a little bit the people that are there. That's clear, but we really tried hard to bring people from Afghanistan and from the near diaspora to the process. That's one point. On the other hand, you must realize that you have a lot of expertise in the diaspora, mm-hmm. and that it's good that people are also talking about coming back, going back, and helping their country.
Some of the Peshawar participants say getting Afghans from inside the country so fast poses logistical problems. The group is uncomfortable voicing political views on the thorny issues being discussed among the politicians, such as the presence of international peacekeeping troops in Afghanistan. But Gol Rahman Ghazi, a law professor at the Afghan University in Peshawar, is open about his views.
Afghans think that under the umbrella of the United Nations, troops from Muslim countries should be deployed for a short 3-2-1. Afghans think that under the umbrella of the United Nations, troops from Muslim countries should be deployed for a short time until security is assured.
The participants are hopeful that this is the golden opportunity to rebuild Afghanistan, and they are excited to be a part of it. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Fariba Nawa in Bonn.
A convicted criminal on the FBI's top 10 most wanted list, Clayton Wagner, is taking credit for a rash of fake anthrax letters sent to family planning clinics in October. Yesterday, Attorney General John Ashcroft announced that Wagner had been named by the Bureau as a top suspect in the hundreds of anthrax threats mailed to clinics in over 12 states. Miranda Kennedy reports from New York.
The FBI describes Clayton Wagner as extremely dangerous. The FBI says he has survival skills and may be heavily armed. 10 days after the attacks of September 11th, Wagner was added to the FBI's 10 most wanted list. According to Attorney General John Ashcroft, Wagner has claimed responsibility for sending more than 280 letters purporting to contain anthrax to East Coast abortion clinics in the second week in October. Yesterday was the first time the Attorney General has spoken about the anthrax attacks received by over 450 women's health clinics in the last 2 months. Although all the envelopes received by the clinics tested negative for anthrax, pro-choice advocates say they have been targeted by a case of extreme domestic terrorism that the Department of Justice has been slow to address. Vicky Saporta is the executive director of the National Abortion Federation.
Well, we have been encouraging the Attorney General to come out with such a statement because we thought it was important that anti-choice extremists know that he's taking these threats very seriously so that we won't have a third wave of threats, because we don't know when these letters will cease to be hoaxes and when they'll really begin containing anthrax, because those active in the Army of God have said that they wouldn't hesitate to use anthrax if they really had it. And then hundreds of people will be put at risk, not only abortion providers, but those who are delivering the mail and the packages and emergency response teams. And it's important that those individuals understand how seriously the Justice Department, the FBI, and other law enforcement officials are taking these anthrax threat letters.
The National Abortion Federation and other pro-choice groups have been asking for a meeting with the Justice Department since this summer, when they saw an increase in aggressive anti-abortion activity outside clinics. In a statement released after Ashcroft's press conference yesterday, the groups cautioned that the investigation should also focus on the network of individuals aiding and abetting Wagner, especially the extremist anti-abortion group, the Army of God. Once again, Vicky Saporta.
They need to be named as a terrorist organization. They vocally advocate the murder of abortion providers and using fatal force to advance their political agenda somehow in the name of God. And so we think it's important that they be treated as the domestic terrorist organization that they are.
Carol Mason authored the forthcoming book, Killing for Life, The Apocalyptic Narrative of Anti-Abortion Politics. She says her research shows the Army of God is just one part of the network that has been protecting Clayton Wagner since he escaped from an Illinois prison last February. Neil Horsley, who runs the Nuremberg Files website, which many characterize as a hit list of abortion providers, is also in this network.
I think Wagner is a very dangerous man, there's no doubt about that. And I think his going to Neil Horsley is definitely to get some publicity and to make it known that he's on this campaign. I think that it's important to realize that Wagner's ideas, however, are not the product of a lone, crazed, fringe lunatic, but are derived from some anti-abortion campaigns targeting clinic workers since 1992.
Clayton Wagner describes himself as an anti-abortion warrior. He recently wrote on the Army of God website, "I consider this a war. It doesn't matter to me if you're a nurse, receptionist, bookkeeper, or janitor, or if you work for the murderous abortionist, I'm going to kill you." Law enforcement officials confirmed that Wagner visited another anti-abortion extremist in Carrollton, Georgia several days ago. Wagner is also the suspect in a Mississippi carjacking and has been indicted on charges of possessing a destructive device, being a felon in possession of firearms, and being a fugitive in possession of firearms, but he continues to elude federal authorities. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miranda Kennedy in New York.
Secretary of Interior Gail Norton has been ordered to stand trial Monday for allegedly filing false or misleading reports regarding Indian trust funds. Federal District Judge Royce Lamberth says Norton must prove she did not commit a fraud on the court in her reports on the accounting system for distributing $500 million in royalties annually to tribes and tribal members. Meanwhile, hundreds of tribal leaders are angered by Norton's new plan to take responsibility for the trust accounts away from the Bureau of Indian Affairs and give it to a new bureau under the Interior Department. Lee Robartis reports from Spokane, Washington, where the National Congress of American Indians is being held this week.
On Wednesday, the Interior Department announced it will begin formal consultations with Indian tribes in mid-December over a proposal to create a new Bureau of Indian Trust Asset Management, which would take responsibility for the trust funds away from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The announcement comes 2 weeks after Interior Secretary Gail Norton angered tribal leaders by revealing her plans for the new bureau without consulting them.
It appears that Secretary Norton is the Grinch that stole consultation.
Tex Hall, who was elected president of the National Congress of American Indians this week, is tribal chair on the Fort Berthold Reservation in North Dakota.
And I hope you had a very good Thanksgiving. We did not. Because we at home are still having to look to our elders, our grandmothers, our grandfathers, and our parents, people who have passed on, who have not received any kind of a settlement, to due to the United States not living up to that obligation. So this is something we take very, very serious.
Attorneys for the Native American Rights Fund say Judge Royce Lamberth's order to have Norton stand trial confirms everything they've been saying about the unfitness of the Interior Secretary to continue to manage Indian trusts. Lamberth had threatened Interior Secretary Gail Norton and other officials with contempt citations if they don't fix the accounting system and determine how much the government owes Native Americans. Court watchdogs say the Interior Department under Bruce Babbitt and Norton has spent $614 million since last year trying, but has failed. The Bureau of Indian Affairs' job is to collect royalties from mining, grazing, logging, and other leases on reservations and distribute them to 570 tribal and 35,000 individual accounts. However, every congressional audit since 1928 has noted poor or non-existent record-keeping, mismanagement, failure to collect royalties, and millions in missing money. The BIA has lost an estimated $10 billion in trust money over the last century through mismanagement. Facing poverty, some tribes have been selling off their resources, taking them out of the trust system. Keith Harper is staff attorney for the Native American Rights Fund.
They have demonstrated quite clearly in our case, and quite clearly in dealing with trust reform issues, that they will always make decisions based on their short-term political interests, and they will make decisions based on what is the best for their litigation posture. That is not how you can reform a trust.
Norton has put Deputy Interior Secretary J. Stephen Griles in charge of overseeing trust reform. Griles, a former mining industry lobbyist, says a study by consultants recommended creating the new agency after the court asked Interior to have a singular focus on solving the problem.
We have not taken action to establish the Assistant Secretary of Trust Reform Asset Management at this time. It is what we believe that we want to offer to the tribal leaders and to the governments to review and discuss and seek consultation on.
As Grile spoke, tribal leaders lined up at three microphones to mostly voice skepticism of the whole scheme. One turned to the hundreds in the room and asked for a show of hands if they favored the Interior Department proposal. No hands were raised. Margaret Baja Walker, council member from the White Mountain Apache tribe, was a typical skeptic. She believes government officials want to strip tribes of their resources and are threatened by the more sophisticated, younger generation of Native Americans.
And now that we're finally beginning to understand BIA, we're finally shook hands and accepted each other, the tribes and BIA. We know each other and we're walking together now. Because of that, they're trying to break the link and make it weak now. They're trying to divide BIA now, and is that another ploy against us?
Many BIA functions, such as Indian Health Services, have already been taken over locally by individual tribes, leaving some to wonder what will be left of the agency after they lose responsibility for managing the $500 million a year in Indian trust funds. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lee Robartis in Spokane, Washington.
Today could be the day that will live in infamy for the city of Philadelphia. Well, perhaps that's a bit too strong, but November 30th is the deadline by which Pennsylvania Governor Mark Schweiker and Philadelphia Mayor John Street must reach an agreement on how to proceed with the public schools crisis in the school district. If an agreement is not reached by tonight, Schweiker could implement his plan to privatize the city's schools as early as tomorrow. From Radio Volta in Philadelphia, Carolyn Napo reports.
In the latest rally against state control and the privatization of the city's public schools, hundreds marched to City Hall from the state office building this week. Representative John Myers of Philadelphia was one of the featured speakers of the event.
The only way to educate is for us to litigate. Because somebody said it's a political struggle. Well, the political battle in Harrisburg is done. We got to take this thing to the Supreme Court now.
Yesterday, the Coalition to Keep Our Public Schools Public filed a lawsuit in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in a last-ditch effort to overturn Act 46, the state takeover law. Around the same time, hundreds of students walked out of their classrooms in protest, wearing buttons that read, "We are not for sale." And today, the NAACP's Philadelphia branch filed another lawsuit claiming that the state takeover law ignores the interest of city residents. Schoolteacher Peggy Bell.
You should go into your local school and see what's going on and talk to your teachers, talk to your administration, and then have the mayor, instead of standing up with rhetoric, have Schweiker, have Street, come right in and talk to the kids and see what's really going on. I'd like to see them sit down and take a PSA examination that they offer in these schools.
Governor Schweiker announced last week that he would not hire for-profit Edison schools to manage the entire district. However, the governor has expressed his intent to still hire the company to manage 60 of Philadelphia's worst-performing schools. The Edison plan would cost the state and the city millions of dollars. With the district already facing a $216 million deficit, many are wondering why the state won't funnel the money directly into Philadelphia schools. Elaine Carty, a public school employee present at the rally on Wednesday.
It's a disgrace because I don't think you can use the backs of kids to make profit for these people to send their kids to private school. And I think if they would give us the money, I think the people in Philadelphia, we have the expertise, we have the talent, that we could solve problems here if they would work with us and give us the money that they're giving to other. Where, how can they find millions of dollars to give other people to, and they can't give it to us? We would like our schools painted. We'd like more computers.
Governor Schweiker and Mayor Street have been in secret negotiations all week with no agreements reached. Schweiker will most likely assume control of the district at the close of the evening. Under the state takeover law, Schweiker has the power to dissolve the school board and appoint his own five-person school reform commission, which Schweiker says would hire Edison. Protesters worried about how a company like Edison will solve the more serious issues contributing to the district crisis. Rosalind Miller works in the public schools and knows that the problems go deeper than the budget.
Well, where do we shovel the mentally ill, the trouble? The hungry child that comes to school every day. The child that's home with a parent that's not home. Somebody's addressing that. All we're looking at is putting out billions of dollars to a company, number one. And then we're going to put more money in a system that we have no control over.
Protesters marched along Broad Street, holding up traffic and startling drivers. In a strange juxtaposition of events, the rally's arrival at City Hall coincided with the city's annual tree lighting ceremony. As hundreds of enthusiastic people engulfed the west side of the building, Mayor John Street was in the middle of the tree lighting festivities. Protesters trailed the subsequent Christmas parade, letting Mayor Street know what they thought of him as he passed by. For Free Speech Radio News and Radio Volta, this is Caroline Napo in Philadelphia.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. More than 40 reporters in 14 states and on four continents are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. Free Speech Radio News only stays on the air with the financial support of community radio stations and donations from listeners like you. You can find out how to support Free Speech Radio News by going to our website, www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Or you can email us at pnnstrikers@igc.org. You can also send a tax-deductible contribution to Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship, 2210 Curtis Street, Apartment A, Berkeley, California. The zip is 94702. Free Speech Radio News is produced by Aaron Glantz, headlines editor Nell Abram, technical producer Jade Padgett-Seekins, technical assistant Matt Martin. We had web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. This newscast is produced at WMNF Radio in Tampa and the Independent Media Center in New York. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Please tune in again Monday for another edition of Free Speech Radio News.